From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The journalist Annie Jacobson makes it clear right at the beginning. In fact, the first sentences in her new book about the super-secret military base Area 51 go like this. This book is a work of nonfiction. The stories I tell in this narrative are real. And Jacobson has to be clear about that because the myths surrounding Area 51 are so fraught with crazy stories and crazy characters. Jacobson explores the stuff that was and is really happening there, the development of secret and sensitive technology that helped the country defend itself and keep track of other countries. But in some ways, the real stories she documents aren't any less fantastic than the phony ones. Today in the program, Jacobson will join us to talk about Area 51 and explain just what is actually happening in that mysterious place in the Nevada desert. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The reason so many people are interested in Annie Jacobson's new book, Area 51, is because this super-secret military base in the Nevada desert is such a mystery. And many of you have heard a story or two from someone who knew someone who heard there was an alien craft being stored there, or that there were these secret weapons being developed, or that there was an underground tunnel system there. And yes, Jacobson does debunk the crazy stuff. She documents what really has happened there, the development of sensitive and innovative technology that helped the country defend itself and keep track of other countries. But it has to be said, the real stories she documents aren't any less fantastic than the crazy ones. Today in the program, Annie Jacobson is joining us to talk about what she's learned of Area 51. That's the name of the book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. Annie Jacobson is a contributing editor at the Los Angeles Times Magazine. Her investigative reporting has appeared in the National Review and the Dallas Morning News. She's joining us today from the studios of Marketplace Productions in Los Angeles. And Annie Jacobson, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I guess I wanted to begin by asking you, what got you started on this story? Was it the same kind of fascination that has captivated so many people over the years?
Not quite. The way that my entree to Area 51 happened was a Christmas Eve dinner in 2007. I was seated next to an 88-year-old physicist named Edward Lovick. Mm-hmm. He leaned over to me and he said, "Boy, have I got a story for you." Now, as a national security reporter, I hear that line often. My work depends on it. But what Lovick told me was astonishing. He said that he had developed stealth technology for the CIA going back to when Eisenhower was president. And the reason that he could tell me this now, in 2007, was because the CIA had just declassified the program after 50 years.
So that got you started. You thought, okay, some of this stuff is starting to come into the public knowledge. I want to break it down.
Yes, I was like, wow, it's a real place. It's not just that mythological, legendary place that conspiracy theorists love to talk and speculate about. And so the next thing I did was I wrote a letter to the Assistant Secretary of Defense requesting that Lovick and I have a tour. Mm. Now, Lovick and the others who worked there, the scientists and spies and engineers and physicists, they often refer to the base as Groom Lake because Area 51 is built around this flat, dry lake bed in southern Nevada, right, which was the perfect place for the CIA to land its first spy plane, the U-2. So when I wrote to the Pentagon, I asked to have a tour of Groom Lake to kind of take the emphasis off of Area 51, which everyone knows the government will not admit exists. Right. And I got back a very interesting letter. And in it, it said essentially that they could not help me with my tour request of Groom Lake, but they put Groom Lake in quotes. And it was this very interesting, almost childish way of saying, that may be part of your vocabulary, but it's definitely not part of ours. And as an investigative reporter, I found that very intriguing, and I wanted to know why this obsessive denial of Area 51. Mm.
You mentioned a little bit of the where this place is. Help us orient ourselves a little bit more. The place, you say in the book, to understand Area 51, you have to know that it sits inside the largest government-controlled land parcel in the United States, which is this immense, immense chunk of land.
It's about the size of the state of Connecticut in southern Nevada, starting about 75 miles north of Las Vegas. And one of the first fascinating facts I learned about Area 51 that seemed to be missing from a lot of the conspiratorial narratives was that also inside of that land parcel called the Nevada Test and Training Range was a smaller land parcel called the Nevada Test Site. That's Area 51's nearest neighbor. It's broken up into quadrants starting with Area 1 and going up to Area 30, give or take a lot of shifting around on the maps of different areas. But what the Nevada Test Site does, what it was set up for, beginning when Truman was president, was to explode nuclear weapons. I found this stunning that Area 51 shared a fence, metaphorically, with America's atomic bombing range. And that was missing from the legend and the lore.
Why do you think that is?
Well, at first I thought maybe it's not as interesting as all the made-up things, but in fact I found out quite the opposite.
Yeah.
You know, the way I report my story is I interviewed 74 men with rare first-hand access to Area 51. 32 of them lived and worked at the base for extended periods of time. And I tell their first-hand accounts of various secret operations that went on there, and then I fact-check it against archives and documents and the Library of Congress files and the National Archives files. And many of the men who worked on these atomic programs tell these remarkable tales. I mean, just stunning nuclear bombs going off in the desert, mushroom clouds larger than the one from Hiroshima or Nagasaki, men driving through Ground Zero with, you know, the hills on fire, a dirty bomb test that I write about from the firsthand perspective of Richard Mingus, who was the security guard there. These are just unbelievable slices of American history that before my book were in essence totally unknown.
I want to break down some of these stories. Mingus is a great character, I have to say. Extraordinary guy who, I want to put that off for just a moment. It's a great story. And there are a lot of amazing characters, I have to say, in the book. One thing I wanted to ask you about, though, to get a sense of this place, I guess if you don't have an invitation, you've got to hoof it some. You've got to take this hike, which you talk about, to Tikaboo Peak. I guess you've taken it. I mean, you describe what you see, because it's as close as you can get, I guess, without an invitation.
Well, I have not taken the Tikaboo Peak hike. I describe it as others have described it to me.
Right.
But what I did, what I was able to do was I was invited by two nuclear weapons engineers, former nuclear weapons engineers, out to the Nevada test site on a tour. And that was stunning. And I was able to get about 7 miles from Area 51 just over the hill. But of course, it's so secret that even the people you're with have to just sort of wink and nod. They can't even really acknowledge that that is where it is.
You say that this is a book about secrets. Most everything about Area 51 classified. You talk about the two projects that have been declassified, but even the name Area 51, you say, was redacted. And I wonder, it seems like there's a kind of a give and take here. It's kind of a mixed bag. On one hand, there's this remarkable technology that has come out of Area 51. On the other hand, there's some really disturbing experiments that went on there, reckless in many ways, dangerous in many ways. I guess it's a mixed bag, what's happened at Area 51.
I think you're definitely right about that. And, you know, Area 51 was set up in the 1950s to push science and technology for military application further and faster than any other nation or superpower in the world could. That is what it was about in its birth, and that is what it is still about today. And it has been that way through the decades. So there also are many players that are out at Area 51 with very different roles.
Right.
I became a fan of the CIA's Science and Technology Department while writing and researching this book because they created these amazing spy planes and espionage platforms that, when you look at them on balance, you have to say, or at least I certainly, my perspective was that these were ways in which America was kept out of nuclear war during the Cold War. The you know, the job of the CIA is to provide the president with intelligence, information based on fact, not on fear or speculation. And that is exactly what they did with many of their spy plane projects. Also there at Area 51, you have the Department of Defense, specifically the Air Force. Sometimes in conflict or at least rivalry with the CIA over a lot of these assets with wings. And then the third major player out at Area 51 is or was the Atomic Energy Commission.
Right.
Now it's called the Department of Energy. And one of the more disturbing realities that I came upon in researching the book, which speaks to your question directly, is the fact that the Atomic Energy Commission has its own system of secret keeping.
Yeah.
And that system runs parallel to the presidential system. And, of course, that's obviously not the way the United States Constitution was written, but it's what the 1946 Atomic Energy Act allowed. And scholars call that parallel system of secret keeping unanswerable authority,
right,
that it gives the Atomic Energy Commission unanswerable authority. And that's where I found the darkest black projects to be hidden. And that is where I found many of the conflicts or the real moral dilemmas about whether or not science and technology should be pushed that far. That's where those ideas came to bear in studying and researching the book.
Well, there's this term or concept you write about that came into being during these early days, born classified. What's so amazing about it is, as you report, this classified status could originate outside of the government in private companies. And you say that some of these private research and development firms could keep this information even from the president if the president didn't have a need to know.
That's absolutely right. And when you first learn that, you really have to sort of do a double take and read it again, because it seems so counter to the Constitution. It seems so opposite of this idea of balance of power. If you give one organization all the power, then that old adage by Lord Acton tends to creep into the mix, which is that power corrupts, but absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I certainly found that in a number of programs at and born in Area 51.
Well, you think about this as, this was something during the Truman or the Eisenhower administration, but you talk about this example in 1994 when President Clinton was president. He had to create a committee to look into these kinds of secrets. And still, I get a sense that many of them, most of them, were kept from him because they said there's not a need to know.
That's right. And that is a very double-edged sword. On the one hand, what the president doesn't know about, he doesn't know about. You know, here I sound like I'm quoting Donald Rumsfeld. Remember when he talked about the Iraq War and everyone made fun of him for saying, you don't know what you don't know. But it really is true. And when you look at the stakes involved, things become very spooky. And that is what I found in bumping up against the Atomic Energy Commission time and time again. Some of the projects that they participated in at Area 51 or spearheaded out there, because they were allegedly calling them safety tests. And that was also sort of a nice cover to say, you know, we're experimenting here for your safety, when in fact it was quite the opposite. It seemed like there was a reckless and dangerous precedent being set by the commission to be able to, in essence, you know, see what happens when you do X, Y, or Z.
When we get back from a break, I want to talk about some of the tests that have gone on at Area 51. some of the more compelling stories that play out in Annie Jacobson's book. It's called Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we have with us the journalist Annie Jacobson. We're talking about her compelling new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. So, Annie Jacobson, talk a little bit about just how difficult was it to uncover all of this information. It seemed, you know, people, it's kind of extraordinary how many people kept quiet for so many years. So how did you, I mean, the declassified stuff I get, but how else did you start to kind of unravel the story?
Well, a lot of the information that I write about in my book had been, in fact, almost all of it had been declassified when I began reporting. Right. It's just that it was deeply buried, and it was buried in a manner that things were very difficult to locate. I'll give you an example. One of the test that I write about is called Project 57, and it was a dirty bomb test out in the northwest corner of Area 51 in a land parcel that got its own name, Area 13. Right. And I had heard about this test, a dirty bomb test, where the Department of Defense and the Atomic Energy Commission teamed up because they were worried, well, what if an airplane carrying one of our thermonuclear bombs were to crash on American soil? What would happen? Would the resulting crash cause a mushroom cloud type nuclear explosion, or would it cause something else, like, say, a dirty bomb? And the only way that they decided they could figure this out was to basically do a mock test using a real nuclear weapon. So they wanted to have a secret place to do it. They needed it to be flat. They needed it to have all these different requirements. And the perfect place was right there in Area 51.
Right.
And when I was trying to get documents to learn more about this test, surprise, surprise, they weren't available at the Atomic Energy Commission archive. And I used a number of different keywords, and I got frustrated, and finally I went into an actual facility in Las Vegas, an archive facility, the library, which is attached to the Atomic Testing Museum, which is a wonderful museum. And lo and behold, the librarians couldn't find the documents for me. So I was getting a little frustrated, and I stepped outside to cool down, and I went into a photo exhibit at the museum, which featured a lot of these atomic bombs going off in the desert. And I was standing there looking at a photograph, and a gentleman came up to me who happened to be Richard Mingus. I had met him once before when I was with another nuclear weapons engineer. And I got chatting with Richard, and I shared with him my frustration about not being able to find these documents. And he said to me, well, what is it that you want to know? Because I was the security guard on that test. So in a very serendipitous way, this is how I actually came across a lot of my sources, and I was able to put together a lot of my information. Many reporters, you know that experience, because you just sort of have to take a dogged approach where you just don't give up. If you know the documents are there and you want to find them, if you ask enough people, eventually I think the information comes to you.
Mingus is, as I said, an interesting character. One of the first security guards assigned to Area 51. He's trying to feed his young family, and you write about, you know, he really takes to this work, and he remembers particularly how everything works with these top secret compartmentalized information protocols. He remembers how it works. I guess how intricate it is, the system.
Absolutely. And I will say, just to add to that other story, is that, by the way, once Richard got talking to me and shared with me his experience, I was able to access those documents. So everything is, you know, you start with a source, an individual, their human story, and eventually you're able to find the documents. At least that's my experience, if something has been classified. But what was so wonderful about working with Mingus and getting his oral history and interviewing him over the course of more than a year was to learn those details, to kind of what I found to be a remarkable context of all of this about Area 51 is that all the men out there, not only are they kind of the best and the brightest at what they do, but they're all pursuing the American dream. Everybody has a family at home. Everybody is debating whether or not they should work more hours. You know, everybody at the end of the day is an American citizen doing their job. What makes it extraordinary is that these men are working on these projects that, unlike the rest of us, they cannot share with their families.
I want to ask you about a test that takes place in the area in the midst of the space race with the Soviet Union. That's part of what seems to be sort of motivating a lot of what goes on, of course. And you talk about, in fact, that, you know, the atomic bomb, you have to understand that. That's the most basic context if you're going to understand what was going on in Area 51. But there's this test that takes place in the 1950s. You report that the Department of Defense was actually considering weaponizing space. And one of the ideas that they wanted to see is, what would it take for us to get a man to Mars? And then in the process, maybe we could create a space base, I guess, where you could launch missiles from space at the Soviet Union. Talk about that, because that was one of the really extraordinary projects that seemed to be going on at Area 51.
Well, you're right that it seems like something straight out of science fiction, except for it's based in reality out there in the desert. And keep in mind that after the Soviets launch Sputnik in 1957, the CIA got a giant infusion of black budget cash from the president's treasure chest because suddenly America had been shamed, America's scientists, and we needed to catch up and surpass the Russians. And one of the ideas was to make these space programs, and eventually that application would be used, as you say, as kind of like a space-based launch pad. But the program began, and it took place at Area 25, which is also called Jackass Flats. It's about approximately 20 miles from Area 51 across the desert in the Nevada test site. And the original idea was to create this manned spaceship to Mars, powered by nuclear propulsion. It was going to have 100 astronauts inside of it, and it was going to be the size of a small office building. It was originally designed by a very famous nuclear weapons engineer named Ted Taylor. And then it kind of transformed over the years into a number of different incantations. By the end, the scientist did figure out how to use nuclear propulsion to get man to Mars. And by the way, this was going to be in 124 days, which is just a stunningly short time frame. But also in the end, there were two factors that canceled the program. And this was – so the program began right around Sputnik, right. 1957, 1958, early 1958. And it was canceled – it took place that entire time out there in the desert at Area 25 and was canceled 1972, 1973 because Americans had lost interest in space travel. They were consumed by the drama of the Vietnam War. And also it became very clear that using nuclear propulsion, you know, kind of launching off of the ground using nuclear energy, if the rocket ship were to blow up, it would be an absolute disaster.
There is, in May of 1947, you write about Army scientists and engineers putting the finishing touches on this, really this immense rocket, the Hermes. It's a rocket, I guess the technology had been created by the Germans and confiscated by the Americans during the war. And so they test it, and there's this you tell the story of one of the tests there. Actually, they tested it several times to kind of disastrous effects, and there was the rocket malfunctions at some point. This was May of 1947, I think it was. Crash lands in a cemetery south of Juarez, Mexico.
Yes. Well, one of the themes in my book has to do with pushing science and technology and where you draw the line at what is moral and what is not. Yeah. And the idea, the genesis of that concept certainly goes back to the moments that World War II is ending. And both America and the Soviet Union are very clear on the fact that the Third Reich had all, or the great majority of the most brilliant weapons designers in the world. And there's this mad rush to pillage the Nazi scientists and bring them over. The Americans wanted them on our side. The Russians wanted them on their side. Our program was called Operation Paperclip. And the program, little bits and pieces have been reported on over the decades, but it's mostly classified. In fact, in 1999, the Associated Press reported that there were over 600 million still classified documents about Operation Paperclip. Many regarding Area 51 are in that pile. And so we did employ many hundreds of former Nazi scientists. The best known example is, of course, Wernher von Braun, who led our rocket team and was involved in those rockets that you just mentioned. You know, and this is a great debate because Albert Einstein took the position in 1946 when he found out about these Third Reich designers coming to America to work for us. He approached President Truman and he said that he thought this was dangerous, that he found that former Nazi officers and high-ranking scientists were unfit for employment in and citizenship in America. But Truman disagreed with Einstein and went ahead with this program. And, you know, there are consequences. There are consequences with putting science and technology before democratic ideals. And that is certainly a theme that I write about in my book. And I think that rocket test speaks to that, because America was far more interested in, you know, getting its missile program up and running than it was in really acknowledging who it was that was in charge of that program. Mm.
You write about that for decades, very few individuals outside of this elite group had given any confirmation that a base was actually there, that was anything really going on at Area 51, that was such a place. Then November of 1989 comes, you write about, and this man named Robert Scott Lazar, Bob Lazar, he, for the first time, I guess, reveals Area 51 to the world. He actually tells it in kind of a remarkable way, I guess. He tells his story to a local TV news reporter. Talk about that, because Bob Lazar starts getting, he creates this national enigma, is how you say. When he starts to tell his stories, people start to think about it. And I'm sure there were a lot of conspiracy theories before Bob Lazar, but it seems like he really kind of ignited all of these questions about what was really going on there.
He certainly put Area 51 on the map in terms of public consciousness. And remember that everything that happens at Area 51 when it is going on is classified top secret.
Right.
And people do not speak of it. Not only are they required by their agreements and certainly their exit agreements not to speak about anything that went on there, but there's also the threat of Leavenworth looming. And no one wants to risk their career or their future. But this enigmatic character named Bob Lazar indeed goes on the television in Las Vegas with a reporter named George Knapp and declares that he was out at Area 51 and he worked on what he believed was a spacecraft and that he saw autopsy photographs of aliens. And this ignited a firestorm. Conspiracy theorists around the country went crazy over this story, particularly because about a decade earlier, the first books about the Roswell crash began to emerge. And even though the Roswell crash took place in another state, in New Mexico, and allegedly took place in 1947, somehow in the public's mind, these two stories, Bob Lazar's story of alien spacecraft and the Roswell story of alien spacecraft, merged right. and became part of a conspiracy theory.
Now, we should say about Bob Lazar, I mean, he had a hard time keeping this to himself. He was dying to really to share this information, even though, you know, so many people had, you know. So he says he knows the schedule of these so-called flying saucer tests. So he conspires to take this trip into the desert and see it for himself. So he invites his wife and he invites some friends. Tell that story, if you will, because he gets caught and he gets fired for doing this.
Yes, and the sort of sacred oath that you do not ever speak about what you did at Area 51 unless the government declassifies the program was broken for the first time by Bob Lazar, as far as the record reveals right now, when he did exactly that, when he was so amazed, according to Lazar, he was so amazed by this technology that he needed to share the experience with somebody else. Somebody else needed to see it. And so he brings his wife and his friends out to the out to a viewpoint on a night where the test will take place. And according to all of them, this is what they see. They see these craft rising up from the desert floor. And they get very excited about it, and they go back a couple times, and on one of the visits, they are stopped and interrogated by the Area 51 security guards, and shortly thereafter, Lazar is taken in and told that not only is he fired, but he's in very big trouble and he can never come near Area 51 again.
But the story, when it goes public, as you just said, it kind of goes the 80s version of viral. I mean, it absolutely goes crazy. And then the scrutiny begins on Bob Lazar and begins to intensify, and some flaws sort of develop in his story. And, you know, again, these questions of, is he telling the truth? Is this just another kind of crazy person? But I guess, how do you process that part of it? I mean, because the stories that you do tell, and we're going to get to a few more of these because they're amazing, actually. How do you figure you want to I guess, did you worry people were going to be skeptical? Some people are. Some of the stories here are like, Annie Jacobson, that can't be true. You have the sources here. You document it. But it's so fraught with that. Do you know what I mean? I mean, that must have worried you as you were writing all of this.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, there's so many stories in the book. I mean, the book is, you know, 400 pages plus 100 pages of notes. And here I'll share with you one story that no one on the radio has asked me yet, which I find astonishing because to me it speaks exactly to the question that you're talking about. Now, I interviewed a man named Hervey Stockman, who is this legendary pilot. He left Princeton during World War II to go fight the Nazis. He fought for this country his entire life. He was the first man to fly over the Soviet Union in a U-2. He told me what that was like. It was an incredible experience, which I relay in the book. He was also an atomic sampling pilot, which means during the early 50s, he was flying planes through mushroom clouds to, you know, grab some radioactive material in the clouds and have it attached to the sticky paper on the exterior of his plane. Very dangerous business. And Hervey told me this other story that I relay in the book, which is that for a period of time, the Air Force decided that maybe it wasn't such a good idea to be sending its best pilots through nuclear mushroom clouds. So instead, they decided to experiment with drones. And most people think, of course, drones are like brand new technology in the war on terror. But in fact, drones were used in World War II, you know, albeit rudimentary versions of them. And drones were used out in these 1952 atomic bomb tests. And Hervey described how the Air Force would put monkeys in these drones. The drones would be controlled by a mothership. I mean, if this all doesn't sound science fiction, I don't know what does.
Right.
So you've got these monkeys flying on drones through mushroom clouds out in the desert, controlled by a mothership. And yet, because there's declassified documentation to back this up, readers seem to go, okay, well, I accept that. Mm-hmm. And yet other things people won't accept. Well, yeah. If that was a program that the Air Force was trying to keep secret, you can be sure that some people would call me up and say, you know, Annie Jacobson, how dare you report such nonsense? Yeah. It's true.
Annie Jacobson is with us. She's the author of the book Area 51, an uncensored history of America's top secret military base. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Annie Jacobson. We're talking about her new book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. Annie Jacobson, I think one of the most kind of compelling conspiracy theories that persists to this day about Area 51 is that the place houses an alien craft that was said to have crashed. You referred to this a little bit earlier. At a ranch in Roswell, New Mexico in July of 1947. And it's this compelling story that you kind of work through a little bit because it provides important context to Area 51. It's compelling because there are sort of these two factors in common, as you say, in the story. And the first is that there had been a crash involving a flying saucer. And the second was that there had actually been bodies, these humanoid kind of type bodies that were had been inside of the flying saucer. And then you work through the reality of this story. And I kind of want to back up, as you do in the book, and talk about the War of the Worlds, because this is the kind of the context to be able to understand not only this particular story, but this kind of hysteria over UFOs that persists to this day. Talk about the War of the Worlds broadcast, because this was an important moment, and it really scared American officials, because Americans panicked, and American officials worried about that.
Yes, well, The War of the Worlds is a Victorian era novel by the British science fiction writer H.G. Wells. And some decades later, in 1938, there was this very famous radio broadcast of the story by Orson Welles. And when that happened, many people who were listening to their radios mistook this science fiction tale to be reality. And they actually believed that Martians were attacking the United States in New Jersey. And hysteria and panic ensued. And people fled their homes. People went to church. I mean, I write about it at length in the book. It's just remarkable the different reactions by people that was all similarly hysterical, believing Martians were attacking Earth. And what I also write is that after this happened, the United States military became very concerned and did a couple interviews with the Associated Press and the United Press, talking about how it was very important that the military kept an eye on this, because people taking actions based on fiction, not fact, was problematic, especially with the coming war. And, you know, it's also interesting that Hitler referenced the War of the Worlds in one of his speeches. And what I write about in the book was this idea that Stalin also paid attention, because the idea of psychological propaganda, of being able to control people or being able to influence populations by misinformation, was suddenly an important government tool. And what I also found fascinating in researching hysteria and UFOs and the way that the CIA dealt with it was that in the early 1950s, when the UFO craze was in full force, the director of the CIA, a man by the name of General Walter Bedell Smith, was overly concerned, verging on obsessed with this idea of UFOs. He would write memos, which have since been declassified, to the National Security Council, warning them that this hysteria, and he used that word, people's, you know, perception that UFOs could invade Earth was dangerous and Bedell Smith felt that the danger lay in the fact that people could overload the, you know, law enforcement channels with cries for help, with fears of alien invasion, and that in turn that would overload America's early air defense warning system and make the United States vulnerable to a real Soviet attack. So I found this fascinating that the CIA, behind the scenes, while pretending it had absolutely no interest in UFOs and pawing any suggestion of it, was at the same time seriously concerned about people's perceptions of UFOs. Mm.
Okay, now here's the amazing part of the story about the Roswell crash. I mean, something did crash. It's clear. You write about in July of 1947, during that first week, U.S. Signal Corps engineers began to track these two objects that were moving across the southwestern United States. And these crafts had these remarkable flying capabilities. And there's one element of this story that has never been disclosed. You disclose it in your book. At the Kirtland Army Air Force Base, just north of the White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico, they had tracked one of these flying crafts. And you say that there was a pilot, Kenny Chandler, ordered into a fighter jet. They said, go and chase this craft. Now take the story from there, if you would, because it's, again, it's remarkable.
Well, something crashed in the desert, and the known facts was that the Roswell Army Air Base reported having its hands on, so to speak, the remains of this flying disc.
Yeah.
Very shortly thereafter, they changed their story to the information that it was a weather balloon. And that is what remains on the record with the Air Force today. But it's impossible not to acknowledge that originally they said they got a flying craft. And this is the origin of the myth of Roswell, which has spawned as many stories and legends as one could possibly think of making up. But what was remarkable to me was in my research, in my reporting, in my interviewing of these 74 men with rare firsthand access to Area 51, all of whom are connected by as a fraternity of men who all worked out there. In other words, they all know each other. If they don't know all 74 of one another, they know they're at least known to, say, 5 or 10, and most know half of them. One of the sources said to me in our very first interview that the myth of Roswell had a shred of truth. Mm. And the truth was that something really did crash out there in the desert. It was shaped like a flying disc, but that it had not been sent by Martians. It had been sent by the Russians.
Yeah.
And that is where I began this process of, over the next 2 years, interviewing this individual, fact-checking every other item that I could about him, about his career, about all of the different projects he was telling me, and making the decision to report this information about what he says crashed at Roswell in the final chapter of my book, which has been getting quite a bit of attention and debate.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I kind of wondered about Andy Jacobson, how much of that part of the story you'd want to say, because not because you didn't want to talk about it, but because it's so – it happens at the end of the book, and you know, how much do you want to give away? And it's so remarkable a story. But I guess the point is that what the United States figures the Russians, because it had Russian block writing on this craft – which is remarkable, they figured that they had gotten hold of even better German technology than the Americans had. And so they wanted to control this story. And so they start looking for who it is that, you know, designed it. That's another big important part of this story. What do we know about the craft, I guess?
Yes, well, you've hit upon a very important part of the puzzle, because while I could not locate documentation to support exactly what the engineer told me in the end of the book, because it is still classified, I was able to put together some very compelling corroboration that certainly suggests many interesting things. And I spoke already about General Walter Bedell Smith and his memos. And I will also add that he often referred to his fear with the National Security Council that the Soviets were going to commit a UFO hoax. And he used that word hoax. And since what my source told me the crashed craft really was a hoax by Stalin, I wondered in my read of Bedell Smith's memos, was he really referring to another hoax? But another undeniable fact is that immediately after the Roswell crash, which occurred in the first week of July in 1947. Just about 4 or 5 or 6 weeks later, you've got these memos coming out of G2 Army Intelligence, which have since been declassified, that they are now on the manhunt for two German airplane designers, former Nazis, called Reimer and Walter Horton, best known for the Horton Flying Wing, and that these brothers allegedly made a flying disc, and the Army intelligence wants to find them and wants to know about it. And this enormous amount of time and treasure went in to seeking information about the brothers. And it's a 300-page declassified file that at times reads like a wild goose chase and at other times reads like a spy novel because they're interviewing everyone to try and find out if these brothers had designed a flying disc. And at the end of the file, after 300 pages and many months of searching for the brothers, G2 Army Intelligence finds them over in Europe. And the last memo says that they admitted their contact with the Russians. And then the file ends, and everything after that is classified. And that, to me, is a very interesting piece of the puzzle, which I by no means claim to have found all the pieces.
So in essence, Annie Jacobson, what Stalin, if this plays out the way the source says it is, Stalin is trying to what? Panic the Americans? Freak them out?
It's a hoax a la the War of the Worlds.
Right.
And from General Walter Bedell Smith, second director of the CIA, we know the fear, the result could be that if a UFO panic were to happen in the United States, the early air defense warning system could be overloaded and America would be vulnerable to a real Soviet attack. So it is there that I infer that that is what the fear was and perhaps the intended purpose.
Mm. Now we have
what
to say,
I also write...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
What I also write in my epilogue and what the engineer shared with me is that what he was told was that the hoax was a warning shot over Truman's bow. Remember, Truman and Stalin were arch enemies already by 1947, and Truman most definitely had the upper hand because we had the atomic bomb. And we were testing the atomic bomb openly, meaning we're not done with nuclear weapons. And the Soviet Union was behind the eight ball because they did not have the atomic bomb yet. And so, according to the source, this hoax was a way of letting Truman know, you may have the upper hand with nuclear weapons, but I have the upper hand with psychological operations. Mm.
Well, I won't get you to reveal too much about this part of the story because it's extraordinary. But we have to say something about the people who were piloting these crafts because it involved this kind of Soviet human experimentation program, these child-sized pilots who had been manipulated. At least this is what the source is telling you. And the shocking part of that story, I have to say, your source told you that the reason the Americans didn't just reveal this, because you asked this question of the source, like, why didn't Truman just trot these photos out and say, look how terrible Stalin is? Why didn't they do that? And you said because they wanted to keep it a secret. And here's the shocking part, because Americans actually talked about doing their own kind of human experiments.
That's right. And that is what the source told me. And that, I believe, is the core of why the source told me what he did. Because for him, it was a matter of conscience. Because here is a man who worked as a contractor for the Atomic Energy Commission across 3 decades. He was a member of the Manhattan Project. He has many awards and accolades. He's deeply patriotic. He dedicated his life to national security. And yet his knowledge and access to this one program that was absolutely a rogue program, and if America really did experiment on humans to see what the Soviets had done, because remember, it was pushing science faster and further than any other nation of the world. So there was the idea that we needed to be beyond where they were. Then not only is that a violation of the Nuremberg Code, but it's a violation of just moral principle to the core. And I believe that is why the source told me this. And that is why I chose to include it in my book.
You know, it made me wonder, when we go back to this question we talked about earlier, of need to know, that in many cases, the secrets at Area 51 were kept from presidents of the United States. Do you think the president, President Obama, for example, do you think he knows some of these stories? Are they told to him officially?
Well, I asked the source the question because in my research, what I really did the focus on in my reporting, after I tell you this, what the source told me, very clearly, by the way, I make a distinction that this is what he told me.
Sure.
I investigated the history of the Atomic Energy Commission, and that is where I came across President Clinton's examination of these crimes and his 900-page report on what had been done to humans by the Atomic Energy Commission in the name of science. And I asked the source that exact question. Why didn't President Clinton find this out when he investigated the other crimes of the Atomic Energy Commission?
Right.
And the source's response to me was, he didn't have a need to know.
Annie Jacobson, she is a contributing editor for the Los Angeles Times Magazine. Her book is called Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base. And Annie Jacobson, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Cynthia Martinez. We have technical direction from Mike Anderson, the program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.